WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it was really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Thank you for joining us as we do our best to put together a good list of folks to join us, to have conversations, to discuss some of the things that are going on, some of the things that are relevant, mostly relevant topics. Sometimes we'll have a book author, sometimes we'll have special guests, but most times we have folks who are somewhat in the know when it comes to things going on in and around the South Shore. We'll kick things off right after traffic, as we'll check in just a couple of moments to find out how things are going out on the roadways with Renee Hamilton. We'll kick things off with State Representative Steve Xaros, as we'll get a little bit of an idea of how things going up on Beacon Hill. One of the primary topics that we'll talk about is a bill that was filed that I believe that he had something to do with, and that is school resource officers in every Massachusetts school. Now, I don't know if he's meaning, if the intent is to make sure that there is, that every community has a police officer or a school resource officer working in each school district, or if the idea is to have every school. I think that would be virtually impossible. I think they'd be taxing on local municipal budgets, but I think the idea is to be able to have at least somebody who is law enforcement background, who is in the school systems. Again, this is because of what we saw down in Uvalde, Texas, with the Dose children being killed and the teachers. So we'll talk with them about that. Also, get the latest with the dangerousness bill. That's a bill that we have had State Rep. Allison Sullivan in to talk about. It was a bill originally filed by Governor Charlie Baker. Find out if there's any update on that. And even get his take on the bill that actually has now, it's going to soon become law, which will give licenses to immigrants without legal status, as long as they can provide some form of identification, passport, be able to drive here legally in the United States. We'll talk with him about that. Then we will talk with an old friend, voice from the past, as he worked as a reporter and an anchor in the WATD newsroom, moving on to WMAL in D.C. a few years ago. Now he is in New York, as he is with CBS Radio. Steve Burns. We'll chat with him and get his take on what's going on as the governor in New York actually has signed some new legislation in regards to weapons. Again, talking gun violence. You saw what happened in Buffalo, New York at that market. I believe this is to make sure that there's there's an age limit in regards to that, at least there's something in place when it comes to someone who is around a certain age in order to be able to get a large capacity weapon. We'll talk with him about that and some of the things that are going on when it comes to gun legislation in New York. Hour number two, we'll speak with author of Every Life a Story, Natalie Jacobson. Remember Natalie? Natalie, who for 40 years as a reporter, first with WCVB and then an anchor. Remember the years of Nat and Chet anchoring the evening news? She wrote a book. We're going to talk with her about the book. The book, and I'm not just saying it because she's going to be my guest. The book is amazing. And if you're somebody who likes audiobooks, she even actually is the voice on her own audiobook, which is fantastic. It gives that special touch to hear your author, especially when there's certain poignant times or sensitive times. You can hear that in the author's voice as to when somebody's just narrating a book. This is so different. So we'll talk with her about this fantastic book, her life, from her growing up in Chicago to getting married and living in Bangkok, Thailand, to how she got into TV and radio. Actually, TV. There's no radio in there. Freudian slip. So looking forward to that. Also, author Dr. Ramil Green, will talk with her in regards to whether we should arm our teachers and school folks. That coming up in just a few moments, but right now, time for us to see what's happening out on the roadways. Being brought to you on this end by Brennan's Smoke Shop, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now Hudson, New Hampshire.
Hey, y'all, got my dukes on. I'm ready to race. Goma's Mini Bach Massacre. This year's theme is hillbillies and moonshiners, so get out them overalls and grab you a straw hat. Meet me at 45 North Carver Road, Wareham, June 25th. The 11th annual Goma's Mini Bike Massacre, brought to you in part by Brennan's Smoke Shop. This year's theme is hillbillies and moonshiners. Pull starts only 224cc or smaller. Waivers must be signed by noon on the 25th. Racers must dress the theme, hillbillies and moonshiners. Food trucks, vendors, live entertainment, live mini bike racing, multiple heats to find this year's winner of the coveted Goma's Mini Bike Massacre. Arkansas, June 25th, 45 North Carver Road in Wareham. Brennan's Smoke Shop assumes no liability for a bunch of people racing mini bikes in a cranberry bog dressed up as hillbillies and moonshiners. So, Zooey! Go get it!
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are back. Time for our usual segment to kick off the show. Other than kind of telling you who is going to be on the radio program, the State House Report that we do on a regular basis. Joining us is a gentleman who I think he loves being on the. I think he loves being on the show. One of these days, we'll get him up here from the Cape and have him right in front of me in the studio. We're talking about none other than State Representative Steve Exaros. Representative, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Hey, man, thank you, brother. I do love being on the show. So you're right. How are you?
I'm pretty good. So just to start things off, how is everything on your side of things? How is everything in your district?
It's wonderful. I love this. It's the fighting fifth Barnstable district, mm-hmm. So I get to represent 42,000 men and women from basically half of Barnstable, all of Sandwich, half of Bourne, and a section of Plymouth. I love it. And but it's very busy, and there's so many issues and so many people hurting in so many ways, and they come to me, and in a way I love it. I think I really was made to serve others. Being a police officer for 40 years, it's kind of another way to keep serving, and I love it, but it's very busy.
So when I reached out to you, and the first thing I was like, would you like to be on, and is there anything that you feel is essential for us to discuss? And the first thing, you're like, yes, absolutely. And it was in regards to legislation regarding school resource officers. If you can give us the nuts and bolts behind this bill to my audience.
Yes, and this is how it works. You're right on. Like, we need to educate people. So, you know, my life police officer for 40 years, from a summer cop with a full head of hair and a mustache to a deputy chief, you know, bald-headed, and loving every minute. I've served in every position that you could ever serve in. And I've 3 college degrees. You know, that's my strength, public safety. And I was a school resource officer for 7 years. So for 7 years, I was in Dennis Yarmouth Regional High School, kind of brand new, like the first one ever on the Cape. And that was in 1987. I served for 7 years. I met hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids, their parents, teachers. And it went from kind of a, what are you doing here, adversarial a little bit, a police officer in a school back in those days, to becoming, you know, best friends. And now those kids are now in their 40s, and I meet their children. So what happened with me is now that I earned the title of state rep, and I love it, when that massacre, horrible incident happened in Texas, you know, here we go again. And, you know, horrible things. More than you even know. Like, so when I look at that, I'm not thinking like a politician, a Republican or a Democrat. I'm thinking as a dad and as a cop, and what they saw and what those children, they didn't even, you didn't even know who they were.
Mm.
It was horrible. So what do we do about it? And when that happens, it's typically, you know, gun control and this and that. And then sometimes nothing happens. And in my world, I know how to fix things. And one way to do it, and we haven't done it, is there should be a school resource officer. This is a real police officer, fully equipped, who has been to training to be a school resource officer. There should be one at every school. So on the Cape and probably in Plymouth on the South Shore, it's been that way for a while where, you know, like in Yarmouth, you know, there's Dennis Yarmouth High School. There's, we've had a cop in that school for 30-something years. We have an office. They have cameras, surveillance. So they provide security, but they're also building friendships and relationships. And that's the missing, one of the missing links. Because in Massachusetts, we've passed every gun law you can think of, pretty much, already. So when a lot of people are talking about assault rifles, AR-15s, licenses, backgrounds, we've done all that. And people should know that Massachusetts leads. And some people don't like it, but that's the way it is. It's really the federal government and 49 other states that have 49 different ways of doing things. But Massachusetts has done a lot. And, but like I always say, you know, just because there's laws, it doesn't stop someone from going to a children's school with a gun or a knife or a car or a baseball bat and doing horrible things. What stops that is a police cruiser sitting out front. And the bad guy, let's say, knowing, you know what, that there is a school, there is a police officer in that building with a gun and trained, not a a former cop, not a, you know, retired, a, you know, person that wants to be there. And when you are in the school, you love it. Like, that becomes your little town. You love those kids and the teachers, and you would never let anything bad happen to them. So I filed a bill last week. We wrote it, got it to House Counsel, basically saying I'd like to see a school resource officer in every school in the state. Of course, it comes down to funding. It comes down to the willingness of the community. And also with that, you need to harden the schools. There are schools in Massachusetts, the doors don't lock, or the inner doors don't lock. Remember, it's not only an outside person that can do horrible things, but it could be a student. So the inside needs to secure. You don't want people going from room to room. And, you know, modern schools have that ability, but we need to make sure the older schools do too. And most of the cities have kind of done stuff like that, but sometimes it's the small towns. So my bill talked about school resource officer at every school, security at every school, like physical stuff, barriers, locks, windows, doors, and the money to train the police and the teachers and everybody to react to these horrible things that can happen, and you want to be razor sharp when something horrible happens. It's too late to sharpen the sword when the drum beats the battle. Like, it's a saying that when things are happening bad, that's not the time to start, like, training. You got to be ready and hopefully prevent it.
As a police officer, we look back at, what, how many years ago was Columbine?
Right.
When you had that, you know, you had the attack on the school, and then we've seen, you know, incident after incident, Sandy Hook.
Yeah.
And now Uvalde to be the latest one.
Yeah.
When does it stop? When does it end? You know, you mentioned about, you know, there's 49 states with 49 different laws. Does it have to go the way of the commercial driver's license, where the federal government steps in and maybe they look at some of the tougher states like Massachusetts, or, you know, name another state that is, you know, has laws on the books for background checks and age limits for large capacity weapons, and says, okay, all across the country, this is what it takes for you to be able to be a gun owner, to be able to purchase certain... Will it come down to that, to have a federal gun license that is in place? And if you mess up, no matter what state, you can't have a gun in any state.
It's possible, right? And that's a big thing, right? So that's where politics and Republicans and Democrats and that's... It's hard to do stuff like that federally. And that's hopefully what they're going to come up with, something. But I'm talking about what works today.
Right.
A politician really doesn't know about school safety, right? So I have friends that's what they do. And I reach out to them. And so we know how to fix it. It's hard in the school. Spend the money to make sure my kid, who's in third grade, is going to a school that has doors that lock, that have, you know, safety built in, that the teachers train in case something bad happens, and has a school police officer there. That's what I would want if my kids were young. The laws help, but it doesn't stop everything. So I think Mass has done a lot, but you need to finish it, and that's with having a real police officer that is trained to make the right decisions. You know, these things rarely happen. You're making, you know, life and friendships every day. Like, that's the bigger part. But when something bad happens, you want someone that's there. And remember, Columbine taught us a lesson.
It did.
And it used to be the cops, right? They're on patrol in a cruiser with a handgun. That's all they kind of have. And you would go to something like that. It's overwhelming unless you're trained and constantly trained, not just once every 5 years, and you're taking on someone with a rifle and body armor and a helmet. You are outgunned. So you would secure and then wait for SWAT. And we know we can't wait for SWAT because it takes too long. These SWAT teams are not on duty. They're police officers that have special training that have to get called in from their homes, and they come together and they arrive and they have the proper equipment. They've trained like every month, so they know exactly what to do to take out, to stop the threat. And that's how we need to make our police officers. Every cruiser should have a rifle. Every cruiser should have an officer that is going to arrive and meet up with two others and go in. And it sounds horrible, and some people don't like to talk about it. I've had that pushback. But if you really want to secure your children, it's not just passing laws. It's hardening the schools, training, and building friendships and relationships of trust with the men and women that serve and protect us.
Right. And you know, my thought here, and our conversation here isn't geared or pointed at law-abiding citizens who know how to handle weapons
and are
law-abiding citizens. That's a key phrase right there. We're talking about the individuals who roguely will go in where there's unprotected individuals and take lives. That's the concern here.
It is, and it's, remember, it's we just read about it. I went to Sandy Hook. Like, I was there physically. And I know what it's like to lose a child. Right. You know, my son was killed in Afghanistan.
Right.
Violently, horribly. I've never seen his body. So when you look in the parents' eyes, like I did in Sandy, at Sandy Hook, like, you know, I think as a protector, it's time that we lead and do the right thing. So, you know, we create a bill, and it's my job to work with my brothers and sisters in government and try to, you know, get something passed and find the money, because the towns can't afford it on their own. But, you know, what is a kid's life worth? And jumping forward, I give the town of Westport credit. They just announced it. I posted it on my page, Facebook page. The superintendent there last week said, after Texas, he said something like, I cannot look in the parents' eyes and tell them I've done everything that you can, because I haven't. And he said, starting today, there's a police officer in every school in Westport, and there will be one forever, and we will find the money to pay for it. So that's an example of leadership, and I just, you know, based on my personal experience, not reading some study, but seeing it, living it, and going to people that do it, and figuring out how do we close the gap. And it's just common sense, boots on the ground. Let's protect our children and the teachers that love them, and we can do it.
She's just tuning in. We're speaking with State Representative Steve Exaros, and we're doing the State House report, talking about a piece of legislation, a bill that he's put forth in regards to school resource officers in every Massachusetts school. We just have a couple of minutes left with you, and if I can, I'll ask one last question regarding this bill. What kind of support are you seeing? Are you seeing a good amount of support, universal support?
Yeah, it's really just brand new. Like, we had to write it and file it. So it'll become public soon. I think every person will support it. But, you know, we did it with the Nero bill, right, that you and I talk so much about.
Yes.
Where you take an idea, you fix a problem, you work with your Democrats and Republicans, you find common ground, and you make Massachusetts history. We did it. And I think we can do it again. Some version of improving school safety and police community relations. It's a win-win. How do I know it? We did it. And we can do it again. And it's a team effort, because we do not want what happened in Texas to happen here.
Well, let's talk, shift our focus to the dangerous bill that is, I believe, I'm not sure if it's in committee right now, where it stands. I believe this is a piece of legislation that the governor has filed, but I know that we've had Representative Allison Sullivan in here, as well as State Rep. Kathy Lenatra, to talk about this bill. Give me your thoughts on this and any updates you have.
Kathy Lenatra is my friend. Allison Sullivan's my friend. They lived it. A lot of times, people like us, we've lived this. Ask me how to build the Bourne Bridge. I don't know that, but I'll find out. But ask me how to protect somebody. That's what we do. And Massachusetts fails. We lead in many ways. But the dangerousness bill, Governor Baker created a bill. It's simple. It doesn't cost any money. But it basically closes the loopholes that career criminals figure out. And Allison Sullivan is a survivor of assault. So we live it. We know it. And this bill should pass. It's currently in committee. And That's where things get worked out. But, you know, the session ends July 31st, and Governor Baker's leaving, unfortunately, in my opinion. So we need to get it done before July 31st. There's a lot of support, and we need to do it. It basically closes the loopholes. Sean Gannon, my officer, the reason why I left the job, ran for office, was the murder of Sean Gannon and the shooting of Nero that happened to me in my department. He was murdered by someone with 125 prior crimes out in the streets with two illegal handguns selling heroin. And so the system did not work. Sean Gannon should be working tonight with Nero. He was murdered. because a part of it, a failure of the system. So there's people out there, they're repeat violent offenders, and they get out on bail, and they're walking the streets. And someone like that should be looked at, and we should close the loopholes. So someone like that needs to be behind bars, because victims come first. And that's kind of what this bill does. If you cut off an ankle bracelet, you go to prison. Mm-hmm. If you get arrested at night when the courts are closed and you have a violent record, you don't just walk out the door after you pay a $40 fee. That's what happens now. You pay $40 to the bail commissioner. It goes in their pocket, and you sign a piece of paper. You promise to be in court. That's how 85% of people get bailed. This bill would say, wait a minute, you have a violent record. You're arrested for another violent crime. You're staying. And until the judge can see you, until there's a dangerousness hearing. Things that people think should happen, this bill does it. And Allison is right, Kathy is right, and we can do this. And that's kind of one of our next missions.
Representative, if any constituents have an issue or if they want to reach out to you in your office, how can they do that?
Absolutely. Give us a call. We have an office in the State House, Room 39. Stop in. We have a Facebook page, but the cell phone number for the office is 508-681-9673. That's our kind of our go-to number. And also email stephen.exaros@mahouse.gov. Phone call, email. Let's build the support. We did it with the Nero bill. Thousands of people signed a petition. This is something like that. There's no real politics to this. This is just something we need to do to close the loopholes that exist to keep us all safer.
Representative, again, thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to having you on in a couple of weeks, as we do. We've got a little bit of a rotation that goes on here, so looking forward to having you back.
And next time we'll be face-to-face, brother.
Okay, there he is.
All right.
State Representative Steve Exaros joining us. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Stephen Burns here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
The pandemic is over and life is finally returning to normal. It's time to return to McGuigan's Pub in downtown Whitman. Come enjoy Shepherd's Pie, a pint of Guinness, and one of the best pizzas you'll ever have on the South Shore. Play Singo Wednesday nights at McGuigan's or listen to the live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night. For comfort food with an Irish pub atmosphere, go to McGuigan's Pub, 546 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out the patio at McGuigan's next door at 552 Washington Street.
Hi, my name is Alex Byzantin, and I'm running for Plymouth County Commissioner. I am the former chairman of the Abington Conservation Commission, former Abington Water Commissioner, and now serving in my second term as Abington Selectman. I am currently serving on the executive board of the Plymouth County Advisory Board. If you would like to learn more about my candidacy, please visit my website at alexbyzantin.org or follow me on Facebook. I am Alex Byzantin for Plymouth County Commissioner, and I approve this message.
Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And continuing our theme, at least this evening, for most of the radio program in regards to gun laws, gun protection, knowing that we have seen incidents, Buffalo, New York, Uvalde, Texas. I thought I would, you know, knowing that one of those incidents took place in New York, I thought I would reach out to a good friend, a former WATD alumni. When he was in Washington, D.C., he was the D.C. correspondent. Now he is now in the Big Apple. So he is now our New York correspondent, Mr. Steve Burns. also a good friend and baseball connoisseur like myself. How are you, Mr. Burns, today?
I'm good. It's always good to be back on WATD. I appreciate your accommodation of moving my correspondence around based on whatever my current job is. So thank you.
Absolutely. And you're also someone who is a valuable resource. Now, before we get into the meat and potatoes of our conversation, when you and I were kind of setting this up, my understanding is that it could be a visual for your employment down the road somewhere, or is that just kind of an appetizer where you actually made a TV appearance in regards to a gubernatorial race? Am I wrong here?
I did. Our friends at the local CBS station here, Channel 2, are kind enough to put me on the air. We co-sponsored gubernatorial debates for both the Democratic and Republican candidates, and I got to ask a couple of questions, and that was very fun. First time I had to wear a tie in God knows how long. Not sure I want to do it again.
Well, you looked fantastic, and kudos to you. I mean, again, you're somebody who is very well-versed, whether it's audio or the visual. So, you know, when you go on to ABC News down the road in 10 years, I can say, I remember him when.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So our conversation, I don't know what the conversations have been since the shooting in Buffalo, New York, followed by, you know, a few weeks later in Uvalde, Texas, where we saw a number of children gunned down, teachers gunned down. There is a nationwide push right now for further gun reform, gun laws. What are we seeing in New York, whether it's, you know, on the state level or maybe you have local leaders who are talking about it?
Yeah, on both levels. I think we saw a very quick response, especially after Buffalo. Buffalo's the hometown of our governor, Kathy Hochul, and I think it very much hit home for her and a lot of lawmakers that this would happen in a state that prides itself so much on having already strict gun laws. I think we saw that this incident really took advantage and exploited a lot of loopholes that still existed. So New York now can lay claim to being the first state to have this very quick response legislatively. Just last week, the governor signed into law a wide-ranging package of new laws, raising the age. I think the most high-profile one is raising the age to buy a semi-automatic rifle from 18 to 21, also requiring a permit to get one. So you'd have to go through background checks, safety training courses. The Buffalo shooter wore body armor, so that was a big point of discussion. Now it's only legal for law enforcement to buy that sort of thing. Also, correcting some loopholes around red flag laws, where now a healthcare professional can say to someone in law enforcement, hey, I think this person may be a danger. We shouldn't allow this person to have a gun. And now law enforcement has the obligation to report that, not just the option. So we saw, I think, a very quick and a very wide-ranging response here after not only Buffalo, but Uvalde. But I think Buffalo was the big kind of impetus that this would happen basically in the governor's backyard. It showed that there was still work to do.
Any comments from local folks who are part of the NRC or who are advocates of the Second Amendment?
We did see some pushback, especially from Republicans who are not a huge fan of these types of laws, as is the case everywhere. There was, I think, one striking comment where a Republican senator in Albany said that all these laws are going to do is hassle gun owners. And then a Democratic senator stood up and said, I want it to be a hassle. This should be a hassle to go through this process. And his name is Gustavo Rivera, he's a state senator from the Bronx. He said he's a legal gun owner, but he said there should be hoops to jump through when you want to buy these sorts of things.
Yeah, that's NRA, not NRC. I don't know why I said that. But, and it's interesting you had mentioned as far as it should be difficult to be able to get a weapon. You should have feels you have earned the right, but not necessarily, you know, just because you come of age to be 18 years old to be able to get a weapon. I think the one thing that I have noticed, and I don't know if how many stories you've done on this as a reporter, it seems that since the pandemic, there is a real rage. There's a real anger that's out there. is this, and this is just in your opinion, as somebody who covers this stuff and has penned your series, your share of stories, do we have more of a mental health problem than we do as to individuals who are able to, you know, get a weapon?
It's a good question. I think it's really a confluence of factors, and that's what makes it so difficult to really tackle and fix. It's a mental health crisis. It's kind of the decoupling of society that we've seen during the pandemic. I mean, we see that on our own city streets in a totally different application where traffic deaths are way up, and a lot of that is being attributed to reckless behavior of people behind the wheel. And I think you can translate that onto gun safety as well. So it's mental health. It's the wide availability of guns. I'm sure you've heard our mayor, Eric Adams, here, very high-profile guy, saying that it's easier than ever right now to get a gun illegally. Those guns that are bought legally in the South and then brought up into New York City and then sold on the street. It's easy to get a gun. Folks don't think there are any consequences when they do have a gun and when they do shoot a gun. He's been railing against the criminal justice system up here. He believes is too lenient on these offenders. He's kind of trying to stake a middle ground here. He's going after the hard left, where he says that they believe there shouldn't be any consequences. He goes after the hard right, where he believes that they don't want any restrictions on gun buying at all. So it's kind of trying to find this middle ground here that may or may not exist, in trying to find a solution to these very wide-ranging issues. It's not an easy thing to do.
As to any research you did, you know, when any of these things have been brought up, whether it's from Mayor Adams to the governor, I mean, is there something that we're going to see pending on the national level? Does something need to be done on the national level that's going to have bite when it comes to some states where you can just actually walk in with an FID card or show proof that you're 18 years old and buy any sort of a weapon?
Yeah, that's always the place that our local leaders point to when they say that's kind of the holy grail of solutions here, is something on the federal level that makes it harder in all 50 states to buy a gun. Because, again, that's what we see in New York, is that it may not be easy to get a gun here, but it's certainly easy to get a gun in a state like Pennsylvania or West Virginia or Georgia and bring that gun into New York and then sell it on the street. So that's the bigger issue that they're dealing with here, and that's certainly a place they like to cast off blame when bad things happen here as well.
Now, I don't know if you had a chance to see the start of the January 6 inquiries, that panel. You know, we talk about national things, and we talk about, you know, we're talking about gun violence, and we're talking about, you know, people dying here. But is this also of a political realm, knowing that, I don't know, I think we were at the height of anger under our previous administration. You saw that where there was almost a revolt, a takeover, because the election results were not to the favor of a group of political folks. I mean, is it bigger than just gun legislation here?
It could be. I know we've seen here in New York that gun buying tends to be very reactionary based on what the headlines are. Even just in the past week, where we learned about the new restrictions on semi-automatic rifles, we've seen a spike in purchases of those before those new restrictions go into effect. So it tends to be a very reactionary type of response. I think just in the five boroughs here, at least in the city, it's not necessarily a political reaction. It's more, you know, we see the different cliques, the different kind of gangs that are on the street. And a lot of those disputes now are just being resolved with guns, where they may not have been in the past, just because of the wide availability and how easy it is to get them. And again, the feeling, at least if you ask the mayor, the feeling that there are no consequences if you do have a gun.
As a reporter, as a citizen, do you see an issue like this being something that is politicized, whether it's someone who's running to be the next governor of New York State or the midterm elections or the elections coming up in 2024 for president?
Oh, absolutely. And I think in a deep blue state like New York, it's a very popular issue to run on when you're trying to rile up your Democratic base to say, we need stronger gun laws. They poll very well. Something like background checks polls very well. So you see that come up quite a bit, especially in federal races, whether you're running for Congress, you're running for Senate. Because on the state level, again, they've passed so many comprehensive laws. There's always more to do. But I think if you're going towards Washington, that's the big issue to run on if you want to bring your Democratic voters out to the polls. And Republicans, of course, the same is true in the reverse. If you are looking to uphold the Second Amendment, if you're a big gun rights type of person, that's the issue that'll bring you to the polls to say, hey, if I get to Washington, then I'm going to make sure you have your right to bear arms.
Yeah, we're living in difficult times, and a part of our, you know, a major part of our conversation is just talking about, you know, incidents that they took place where lives were lost due to a weapon, a gun. But also, look what's happening with, you know, being able to live day to day. I can only imagine we're seeing gas prices here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts at around $5. There hasn't been times that I haven't gone to New York, and usually it's a little bit more costlier. What is it like to be a New Yorker, whether it's to buy a gallon of gas or to make a regular purchase? How has the cost of living affected folks who live in New York?
It's certainly being felt. I've done, I don't know how many stories about gas prices at this point. And usually when you're doing any kind of story where you have to talk to someone on the street, you know, you're shoving a microphone in their face saying, hey, would you mind talking to me about X subject? You know, 75% of the time, the answer is no. But doing a story on gas prices and going to a gas station and talking to someone as they're filling up and putting a microphone in their face and saying, hey, do you want to talk about this? I'd say 90% of the time, the answer is yes. This is something that people really are not happy with. It's an open question about who's to blame for this. Obviously, the popular rhetoric is casting blame on the current administration. They're going to say this is not in their control. There's so many other factors at play here. But, you know, it's all over the place. It's hard to avoid on gas, on groceries. And again, I think it goes back to that kind of decoupling of society a little bit, where it feels like, you know, it's every man, every woman for themselves at this point. That's kind of leading to this change in mindset where we see more gun violence, more traffic deaths, you know, more dangerous society overall that folks are looking to fix.
Well, you know, if we were looking for a bright spot, probably the bright spot would be in sports, seeing that both New York baseball teams are doing remarkably well.
Yes.
The Yankees are on a torrid pace probably, you know, punch their ticket into the playoffs. And the Mets are right there as well. Being a baseball guy and a sports fan, does this bode well, or does it make you sad? Because I also know that deep down inside you are an Oakland Athletics fan.
Deep down inside, I don't know. I haven't watched too much this year because they are not doing very well. I don't know. I'm somewhat partial to the Mets now, and I'm not saying that just because my station has their games, but it's a fun team to watch. The Yankees are a fun team to watch. If we're on our way to another Subway Series, I think that would be great for this city. I mean, I don't want to make New York sound like it's this apocalyptic hellscape right now, because it's not. Shootings are going down, and they're, you know, crime is nowhere near where it was back in the 80s and 90s. It's a very fun place to live. It's a fun place to visit. And, you know, baseball, I think, is only helping things, knowing that it's in the spotlight right now with both of its teams doing very well.
You mentioned the Subway. And again, we're speaking with Steve Burns. He is a good friend, a WATD alum, a former anchor here at 95.9 WATD, and now taking his talents to the Big Apple and doing work for CBS Radio, and we're fortunate to have him on here from time to time. Knowing that gas prices are kind of, you know, skyrocketing, is this kind of a boon for transit, for public transportation?
I think that's secretly what they're hoping, because we're seeing traffic levels already exceeding pre-pandemic levels.
Yep.
But ridership on the subway and the trains is still about 60% of where it was. So they're really hoping to get people back on mass transit for all kinds of reasons, to reduce traffic, to reduce pollution. It's just a more sustainable way to get around. So if gas prices help them in that respect, I don't know if you'll hear the bigwigs at the MTA say, hey, gas should be at $7 or $8 a gallon. But secretly, they're probably hoping that that's the case. The big issue here is perceived safety on the subway. We've seen a lot of high-profile safety incidents on the subway recently, and that's the headlines, more than anything else, are really scaring folks away. So they've put more officers patrolling the subway. They're doing all they can to make it seem as safe as possible, and that's what they hope will drive people back.
If you had your pick of the three subway systems that you've had a chance over your lifetime, whether it's down in D.C., you know, riding the metro here in Boston, or in New York, which one is I don't know, your overall favorite, or have provide you a sense of amusement from time to time, because all of them can be quite entertaining depending on how you take in the experience.
Yeah, no, entertaining is an interesting way to put it. I don't know. I'm partial to the T because I went to college in Boston. I rode the B branch every day to get from my apartment in Alston over to Emerson College by the Boston Common. So the T will always have a special place in my heart. Washington Metro, not the most well-managed, well-run system out there, at least when I was there back in 2016, 2017. But the New York City subway is iconic. It cannot be beat. It's so vast, so expansive. It's actually running pretty well right now. Service is doing pretty well. So the T, very special place in my heart, but I got to go New York.
All right. Well, listen, we're about out of time. I want to thank you for sharing your insight, your wisdom, and part of your craft with my listeners as to, you know, what you report on and what you're following as a newscaster and somebody who has his finger on the pulse of what's happening in our country. So, again, thank you for being a valuable resource to my listening audience.
Always a pleasure to be on Monday Night Talk. Always a pleasure to be on WATD again. It holds a very special place in my heart. I think back fondly to those days. So thank you.
He is Mr. Steve Burns. He has been our guest. That does it for the first hour of Monday Night Talk. Yeah, I know. It went fast. Hour number two. And we got a special book author joining us, Natalie Jacobson, who will be joining us here in just a few moments. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
I'm Tiny of Tiny Sun's Glass. If you're driving along right now and you've got an angry little ding in your windshield,
ouch!
But good news, we can fix that ding. We'll fix that ding before it spreads. Drive on over to Tiny and Sons, Route 53 Pembroke. We will fix that ding. Your insurance company will pay.
And that's why I sing the gimme, gimme that ding.
So gimme that ding. Tiny and Sons Glass will fix that ding. Insurance company will pay.
That's right.
My dad did a great job. 1-888-64-TINYS. Just call.
With summer coming, it's time to enjoy alfresco dining at the Patio at McGuigan's. The Patio at McGuigan's serves up dishes like Koji steak tips, 14-ounce pork chops, and chicken masala. Have you heard about the Patio Sampler Platter? It's a dish worth driving to. And you can enjoy live entertainment every Friday and Saturday night at the Patio at McGuigan's. Patio at McGuigan's is at 552 Washington Street in Whitman Center. And check out McGuigan's Pub next door at 546 Washington Street.
Ahead, indulge yourself. Every Wednesday night, tune in to Talk with Francesca and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both, because being connected feels good, and who doesn't need more of that these days? Don't miss Talk with Francesca Wednesday nights at 9 on 95.9 WATD.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Again, we await our guest to join us just shortly. And again, guest be Natalie Jacobson. Every Life a Story. This is a Peter E. Randall publisher. And my understanding from reading the book was that this was something that was done during the pandemic. This Natalie wouldn't be the first guest that I've had on who penned or put a book together during the pandemic, but that's how this came to be. I guess my first question, once we do have her on the line, is, you know, was this something that was in the works? You know, again, this is someone who with a Serbian background, grew up in Chicago, and part of the conversation that we'll talk about, talking about this book, I mean, how many out there remember, you know, watching Channel 5 in the early to the mid-70s, the 80s, and seeing Natalie and Chet Curtis? It's interesting because I want to say it was like 17, 18 years ago. I remember actually bumping into Chet Curtis. Chet being someone who he would be, I would see him at the Alba in Quincy, kind of a piano bar. A very personable guy, somebody who liked to sing and chat. Definitely something interesting. But knowing how, you know, they were part of the news. Just think about it. How in the 70s, how things have changed over the years, how things have evolved. You're talking about a time when WCVB came along prior to the 24-hour news cycle, the Ted Turners, when we get, you know, CNN and news around the clock. Well, this is, you know, back, there was a time when we didn't depend on Twitter or the latest, you know, blogger to put something out there. We depended on local news, whether it was here, 95.9 WATD in the late 70s, early 80s, 90s, to, you know, local newspapers, to our Boston TV stations for what was happening in the area. That's what I remember growing up. And joining us to talk about her new book, Every Life a Story, Natalie Jacobson reporting, is the author herself, Natalie Jacobson. Natalie, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I had trouble getting through to you, so I'm a little delayed in catching up. I'm sure it's my stupidity, but for some reason I couldn't connect.
Well, I will say, just right out of the gate, I had an opportunity to preview a copy of the book, but I was also, I'm somebody, I'm a big fan of audiobooks, and a lot of times they're narrated. There's somebody who will narrate a book for an author. I found it amazing and refreshing to hear Natalie Jacobson basically narrating her own book and hearing and feeling the emotion of certain topics and certain subjects and you know, raw emotion depending on what the subject was. So I want to say, first and foremost, I was able to enjoy a book in two forms.
Oh, well, that's so nice. Thank you. That makes me feel great. I really appreciate that. I did record it, and it is, both the hardcover and the audio are available on Amazon and the ebook. So thank you very much. You make me feel good.
So, you know, let's talk about deciding to write the book. I believe that you indicated in the book that the pandemic was something that kind of spurred you to write this. Was there a plan to to document your career and your life and some of the things that you experienced before that or after?
It's a good question. You know, sometimes life just presents you with an opportunity and you got to grab at it. My brother, to start the list, and many people that I didn't even know would stop and say, have you written a book? And I'd say, well, no. But if you did read a book that I wrote, what would you hope to read about? And people would say things such as, stories, just tell us stories. Well, it was hard to focus on that. And then when, in March of 2020, when COVID hit and everything shut down, you couldn't even go and play tennis or golf or anything. You just were locked up wherever you happened to be. It occurred to me that this is the moment. Excuse me. My allergies are kicking in here. If you're ever going to write this, this would be the time. So I sat down at a computer, and I have no idea how this happened, but the memories just flowed. And for the next 6 or 7 weeks, every day, I just wrote off the top of my head for about 5 hours a day, and that's how it happened.
How easy was it? Was it therapeutic to talk about your growing up in Chicago as this Serbian kid, a family, you know, your parents were first-generation Americans? Was it therapeutic for you?
Was what therapeutic? I'm sorry.
Would you say writing about, you know, growing up in Chicago and your past, little known things that we don't know about Natalie Jacobson?
Well, sure. You know, nobody runs around telling them their biography, but I don't know that it was therapeutic. No, I wouldn't look at it that way. I felt I didn't want to write a memoir that was all about me. I mean, who cares? But I do believe that you need to know who your author is. If you want to read a book, who's writing it? I feel that way about when you Google things and who just said that, or Wikipedia or any of the online media sources. So that's why I included a chapter about who I am and how I was brought up, to help readers understand where I'm coming from when I say whatever it is I say. Does that make sense?
It does. And again, it helped me kind of understand who you were, even from how you learned to perfect English, because you were teased by the kids in school, correct?
Yes. Well, yes. I was born during World War II, and we lived with my grandparents, who had come from Serbia. So English was hard for them, so they spoke primarily Serbian. So as a little child, and the first of four in my family, I learned Serbian and spoke it most of the time. And it wasn't until I went to school that I had total immersion into English. And my mother, God bless her, the sweetest lady in the world, said, you'll be fine. And I was. By Thanksgiving, I was totally fluent in English. Of course, it helped, as I mentioned in the book, that my parents were bilingual.
And you also kind of mentioned, I mean, your dad is quite a success story in himself. Am I correct? Where someone who was a cab driver who, to be, you know, someone who was overseeing Gillette.
Yes. I mean, it was a great example. And I think it wasn't until in my later life that I realized that the fact that he didn't have a college education, he didn't have any contacts, he was certainly not worldly. He was a typical immigrant son. That he could achieve what he did from when I was a little girl, you know, first a taxi cab and later running a bowling alley, and then selling razor blades for Gillette Safety Razor in Chicago, and then moving through the ranks up to being the president of Gillette North America is an American story. You know, it's only in America those kinds of things happen. And so when I was faced with, as a girl, a female, you know, girls need not apply. You will just get married, have babies. Why do we want to train you? I got that. I understood it because my own father was from that generation. But I also realized that by example, the fact that he didn't give up and he just kept going and tried his best and succeeded, that I could do the same, even though I was a female, and females at that time were not in vogue for the obvious reason. I got it. You're going to get married, you're going to have a baby, and you're going to leave us. Of course, I said, well, gee, this is a new generation. We maybe want to think a little more broadly.
And luckily, a conversation with your godfather, you nearly almost weren't the first one to go to college in your family. Thanks to your godfather, you were able to, correct?
Exactly. He had a daughter, or has a daughter, exactly my age. We were both born in the first 2 weeks of August of the same year. And my godfather asked my dad, where's Natalie going to college? And my father said, you're kidding, you're sending Diane to college? It was foreign to him. It wasn't because he was mean, or it just was foreign to him. So my godfather said, yes, Willie, you know, girls go to school now. It's a new age. So my father relented and said, well, maybe we could apply. Of course, I was very angry with him because, and I talked about it in the book, because it was late. It was my senior year. Who the heck's going to let me apply? But it worked out. And so sometimes, you know, the different paths to get to where you might want to be.
But you ended up going to, you had three schools to choose from, and one of it ended up being University of New Hampshire. And but you didn't go to school for journalism. Is that correct?
No, I didn't. I had no idea what I wanted to do when I grew up. I had no clue. There were not very many opportunities for girls back in the 60s, mid-60s. You could get a good job as a secretary. You could get a good job as a nurse. You could get a good job as a teacher, primarily. Those were the jobs that mostly were available to girls. And, of course, there were certainly exceptions. And while those are wonderful professions, and thank God people want to be in them, they just didn't interest me. So, it's just the way it was.
No, I don't want to jump over you getting married and living in Bangkok, Thailand. That I thought that was an interesting story, and how you learned to live there and then coming back to the States. I mean, you were employed, but you weren't sure how you were going to be employed. I think the one thing that I that made me chuckle was understanding the coverage of the Vietnam War, and how did they get the pictures and the sound in that little box. That kind of generated your interest in broadcast television, correct?
Well, you know, it sounds bizarre today with all we have in terms of technology, but yes, I think you're referring to a part of the story of my background where I said, when I was trying to figure out what do I want to do with my life, mm-hmm. and I looked at a number of different things, but I was watching the Vietnam War with Walter Cronkite, and I thought, wow, what are they doing? How do they get all those pictures and sound and stories inside that little box? And it sounds silly to say it that way, but so I applied to various television stations when we got back from Bangkok, and which was, by the way, better than getting a master's in anything. It was extraordinary to be introduced to a whole new culture during a difficult time. And I did apply, and I could not get a job. Nobody wanted to hire a girl. So one person, Jim Thistle, who later became the best news director I think we ever had at Channel 5, due respects to all the other wonderful people who are great news directors at Channel 5, he was the news director at this little UHF station in Boston, and said, I read your portfolio. I can see that you can write, you can think. I think you'd be a good reporter someday. And if you can wait a year, I will hire you. But right now, I don't have money in my budget for a cub reporter. And I said, okay, I'll wait. I was waitressing. I was working at various... let me just get rid of this noise that's coming in here. Sorry. At any rate, a year later, he did call. And he said, you know that job I told you about? And I said, yes. Well, I don't have that job, but I have something else. I said, fine, I'll take it, whatever it is. I just thought, I don't know anything about television. I have no idea. What do they do there? How does it work? And I figured if I got in, I would find out, and I was young enough, 20-something. if I find out if this was for me or not. If it wasn't for me, I'd try something else.
And I think the thing that was interesting is not only did you write, you were able to write something up and do a presentation that was went over quite well. I mean, at first, my understanding, the way I understood it, was that you weren't sure as to how well it would be received. And you were hoping, I think, to glean a job out of it. But eventually, that's not what happened. I believe it wasn't until there was a little bit of a takeover, WHDH, which eventually became WCVB, where, you know, you actually started creating programming, right?
Well, it was an unusual journey to get to the job I eventually had that you're referring to, yes. Mm. So while I was at the Channel 56, the UHF station that I just mentioned, I was asked to do what the FCC required all stations to do at that time, which was to ascertain the needs of the community. What that meant was you had to go and interview everyone from the governor and the mayor to just regular people who were working in any number of fields to basically be able to write a report to the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, saying we have ascertained the needs of our people. What a gift, as I look back on it, for a woman who wanted to be a reporter. You had a sense of who you were talking to, who you were talking about. So I did that for Channel 56, and then Channel 4 hired me only because I had that experience, and their license was up for renewal. Back then, you had to renew your license every 3 years, and you had to prove some things. You had to prove that you were fair on issues. You had to prove that you gave equal time to candidates. So that was how I got in. And then at WBZ, which was the powerhouse at the time in Boston, I had an opportunity then to put my information to use. We're so used to today, public service announcements and such things, but they weren't so common then. And I was able to do that and work with some experienced producers and produce shows that mattered to people who were watching us. It was an extraordinary experience. And then finally, it would take way too long to go into detail.
Sure.
I hope people read the book.
You read the book.
And then finally, I got to, as you mentioned, to WCVB, which after a protracted fight, won the license to operate Channel 5. It's an unusual journey. I feel lucky to have managed to go through that. And I think if there's one thing about the book that I hope people appreciate is that I do feel lucky and that I do feel there's more than one path to get wherever you might want to go, even if you don't know where it is you want to go. But if you keep your eyes and ears open and you're receptive to other people's thoughts, ideas, and what's going on in your world, life can be very rich.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Natalie Jacobson, Every Life a Story. We're talking about her memoirs and the book that she has written. And again, if you're somebody who likes reading, this is a great read. If you're somebody who likes listening to audiobooks, it's the voice of Natalie. And it's like it transports you back to the days of when she was on the air and some of the things that she endured. Can we talk about the first time that you and Chet actually anchored together? I believe it was a marathon, and not an actual marathon, but I believe there was a special guest. There was a special ceremony going on, our bicentennial.
Right. Well, it's a great story. Just very briefly, in 1976, the United States celebrated our 200th anniversary, and the Queen of England was coming to Boston. And remember, we're Boston people. Coming to Boston to celebrate America's independence from Britain. What an irony. And our news director, Jim Thistle, said, we're covering this from the moment she steps off the Britannia to the moment she goes to bed back on her ship. So we were on the air for over 8 hours of live coverage. We fielded. I realize that young people listening to this might say, big deal. But we fielded 11 live cameras, which were connected by microwaves, not satellites, not digital. This is 1976. And what it became was a history lesson about the United States independence from Britain. And people all across New England were engrossed that this, they were watching this, an extraordinary irony, if you will, and came, actually left their TV sets in Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, and came to Boston because, as they wrote to me later, we had to taste it and feel it and see it for ourselves. It was extraordinary. And Chet and I were paired for the first time for that broadcast. And our boss, Bob Bennett, the wonderful general manager who's responsible for the success, the early success of WCVB, and the continued success, I would add, thought we were a good match. And that's how that started.
And you yourself, a trailblazer, first woman to anchor in the Boston market. Is that accurate to say?
Yes. To anchor these 6 and 11 o'clock news.
Correct.
Yes. And, you know, I don't think I thought too much about it at the time. And it seems late in the game, but not really. TV was new, you know. So, I don't know. Just got lucky again, I guess.
Your book talks about so many different interviews, so many different conversations, whether it's with Dr. John Silber and the incident regarding a phone call from Dr. Henry Kissinger, and learning information later on to running for, you know, being sought after to run for Congress, which you declined. But talk to me about some of the great interviews that you've been able to do over your career, over the years, 40 years, and what's the most memorable ones that still stay with you to this day?
That's impossible to answer, and so many people do ask me, and I don't mean to be disrespectful.
No.
But the interview, the most important interview was the one I was doing at the time. And, you know, as you look back through these interviews, and it was not an intent on my part when I wrote this book, but I see it as I read what I wrote, that life is a continuum, and the issues that existed in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and early 2000s, many of them still exist. And I think that's a very important, it's important to me to recognize that. For example, racism, abortion, education, immigration, you name it. These things don't go away. They're a continuing part of life in this extraordinarily wonderful country. And I hope that if you read the way we covered it in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, that it's not ancient history, that you see the same issues that we face today, how we covered them then, as opposed to how they are being covered today. It was without rancor. It was without bias. It was without anger at anyone who had an opinion different from ours. And we kept our opinions separate on a different page in a newspaper in a different place called an editorial in a local newscast. And I hope, and perhaps this is too much but to hope for, but that's me. I'm the eternal optimist. I hope that in reading this, you see that there are better ways to cover news. There are better ways to get along. There are better ways to compromise. And I think the book proves it. Not just my book, but I hope you read other history. Mine's not a history book. I hope you read history and see there are better ways than the way we're doing it today.
Well, I think, again, and I was going to bring up Julia Child and you know, doing an interview with her prior to them taking all of her stuff to the Smithsonian, you know, before she left Cambridge. I thought that was a great story. Probably one that I would ask you to kind of talk about is learning to fly. Knowing that all the guys were flying, you learned how to fly, and it was like the first time you flew by yourself and had to land at a field. Could you share that?
Sure. I guess I don't mind telling embarrassing stories about myself. I was at a dinner which involved a whole bunch of people associated with Channel 5, and everybody flew. And I was the only woman at the table, and I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be dreadful. I don't know anything about flying. And they talked about it all night. So the next morning, I got up and went to Norwood Airport and said, I'd like to take a demo ride. I'd like to know why everybody's so excited about this thing called flying. So So I took a demo ride, and that did it. I was hooked, and I signed up for lessons, and I learned how to fly a single-engine plane. And I have to say, it was exhilarating. It was a challenge, and I loved every bit of it. And then the first time I was all by myself without an instructor sitting in the seat next to me to save me from whatever wrong I might do, it was beautiful. It was a sunny day, and I was excited, and my job was to fly. This is part of getting your license, was to fly to a particular point and to get your land and get your logbook signed and come back. It was my first cross country, as it was called. And I landed at the wrong field. I landed at a military base, which in air, which is right next to a civilian base. And as I was coming in for a landing, I went on Unicom, which is what you do at a field that doesn't have a tower. And I announced my arrival, and all of a sudden I looked up and saw there was a tower. So I knew I was in the wrong place. I wanted to die. Oh, my God. So I landed, and, of course, the military guys are charging my airplane, waving frantically at me. I just played dumb and waved at them, gave them a big smile, went back to Unicom as though I didn't realize I had come to the wrong field, and took off. Went to the right field. Had my book signed, went back to Norwood, and my instructor said, "So how did it go?" I said, "Oh, great, Rob, no problem." He said, "Maybe not." So I'm lucky I didn't land in jail, I guess. Or in a brig.
Yeah, can't have that happen. And again, if
no, you mentioned Julia Child. That's illustrative of the many gifts of being a local reporter. Right. You get to meet everybody. And extraordinary people. And in a city like Boston, which is just filled with so much in the way of extraordinary people, I called Julia and said, "I just read that the Smithsonian Institute is coming to your house in Cambridge, and they're going to take away your kitchen. And I also understand that you're moving. You need to talk to me today before all this happens. Your fans will demand it." And fortunately for me, she agreed to do it. But that's, you know, how great is that? How lovely, how wonderful, how lucky to have an opportunity to just make a phone call and do something that much fun and that brought people a lot of warmth, I think, in listening to her.
Well, and I would say this is, I wish we had more time because I wanted to talk to you about the cooking videos you did with Jasper. I mean, there's so much in this book that folks should get a copy of this book to read, you know, cover to cover. Probably the last question I would ask you, other than where folks can get copies of it, and that this is in regards to reporting. What do you feel is the role of a local TV reporter or anchor? And second part of that, do you miss being on air?
Well, the first part, the role is to tell people what's going on. Your job is to inform people so they can make smart decisions. Your job is to acquaint them with other people in their community. It's your job is to relate national and global events to your local scene. So you bring, in essence, your job is to bring a community of people in your area together. In terms of, do I miss it? I miss the camaraderie with my colleagues, and I miss the opportunity to cover news, yes. But it's changed so much that I wouldn't be able to do today what we did then. It's just a different world.
If folks want to get a copy of your book or they want to hear your book, the audio version, how can they find out more about your book, Every Life a Story?
Thank you for asking. I had to self-publish because I found out that publishers don't do local memoirs. So, at any rate, I think the easiest way is to go to Amazon and you can get any of the three things, either the hardcover book, or the ebook, or the audio book, which I recorded as you noted.
I want to thank you so much. It was an honor and a privilege to be able to speak with you, an award-winning journalist, somebody who played an important role to not only my life, but many folks who remember, you know, from the early 70s to the early 2000s of you being on air in your interviews and how you informed us and kept us up to date as things that are happening in and around our area and around the world.
Well, thank you. And thank you very much for having done your homework and reading the book and listening to it. I really appreciate that. Not everybody does that. So you're a good man, Charlie Brown. You're good at what you do, too.
There she is, Natalie Jacobson, our guest. We're going to step aside. One more guest, one more author on deck. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than two or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
This tech update is sponsored by Dell Small Business. Google Maps is introducing a cool new tool, Immersive View, which takes Street View to the next level. Want to walk around a neighborhood you're interested in visiting before you get there? Immersive View's machine learning drops you right in virtually.
Dell Technologies advisors are here with tools and expertise to help you do incredible things. For a Latitude laptop, Dell Technologies recommends Windows 11 Pro for Business. There's an innovator in all of us. Find tech that suits you by calling a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL.
Thanking fathers from O'Reilly Auto Parts. This Father's Day, remember to thank your dad. Thank him for having patience when teaching you how to drive. Thank him for making sure your car was always road trip ready. Thank him for all the lessons he taught you on and off the road. Here's to wishing a happy Father's Day to all the dads. Thank O'Reilly Auto Parts for all of your car care needs. Get guaranteed low prices and excellent customer service from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
By the middle of the week, so much news has come your way, you need your own team to sort it out. Lucky for you, there's Jared Valenzuela and the JV team to talk about the things you've heard and catch you up on some things you might not know.
I'm Jared Valenzuela. Join me and my guests as we have fun with current events and try to put things into perspective each week. Sponsored by Corey Welch of Boom Realty. Catch the JV team every Wednesday night at 6:15 here on 95.9 WATD.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back for final segment of Monday Night Talk. A great conversation.
We'll put the podcast up sometime this week. If you've missed any of the segments, keep that in mind. Also, we want to take a moment to thank our great sponsors, Tiny and Sons Glass, Signature Healthcare, and McGuigan's Pub. Our conversation now, we will focus and speak with Dr. Green. Dr. Green has been a school teacher and administrator for more than 45 years. Also the author of Please Teach Me Like a Boy, 10 Steps to His Success in School and in Life. She is also an executive of the Boys Initiative. Doctor, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Kevin, hi. Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to ask you, because I said Dr. Green. Is it Vermel?
Vermel, that's correct.
Nice.
Very good.
Right. Excellent. Well, welcome to the radio program.
Thank you again.
And let's first start. Tell us a little bit about your book. Please Teach Me Like I'm a Boy.
Boys learn differently than girls, and unfortunately, many teachers have not been trained or even informed about that. I know I hadn't been, and
I was in the classroom for a lot of years, and even as an administrator, it wasn't until I was close to retirement when I began to do research as to why boys were maxed out in special education classes, and there were hardly any in the talented and gifted classes. Why our boys were getting suspended over and over and over again, getting in trouble, and began to just search around and read and found a book that said boys and girls learn differently. And I thought about that. I said, well, my goodness, no one ever told me that. That explains why he would do that and she wouldn't do that and vice versa. So I wanted to put much of my dissertation in book form when I did research on how boys learn and how best to teach boys. And so this was my COVID book, you know, when they said, you can't go anywhere, you know, just stay home. I said, okay, I'll write a book. Please teach me like I'm a boy. 10 steps to his success in school and in life.
I will tell you that Amazon and Barnes & Noble have definitely benefited from the pandemic because so many people thought it would be something to do, sit down, I'm going to take my time dedicated towards that. You saw it as an opportunity not only to write the book but also as a dissertation. How long did it take you to put the book together?
Well, as I said, a lot of it came from my dissertation, my doctoral dissertation. So I would say I started right after they shut things down, and it was published about 4 months later.
Talk to me about serving as a school teacher and making the transition from being a school teacher to an administrator.
Oh, my goodness. Kevin, I have to go way back to that. And see, I taught... I started teaching in 1974, and I taught for about 8 years, but I wanted to do something really, you know, really different. So I left teaching and went to work for the Xerox Corporation. And Xerox at that time had all these former teachers running around because Xerox wanted the skills and talents that teachers had, you know, public speaking, organizational skills, being able to work unmonitored. But I was only at Xerox for about a little under 5 years and came back to teaching. In teaching a short time, and my principal began to promote me to administrative roles, and eventually I became assistant principal, dean, principal, and then I retired soon after.
You know, it's interesting that, you know, we're seeing more and more gun violence in schools. It's becoming common a common occurrence. You look at Columbine in Colorado. Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut, and now this the latest incident at the Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. In your opinion, what needs to be done to protect and preserve the educational environment moving forward?
Many of the relatively simple ways to protect our children are readily available. For example, in the inner city, you don't see many of these things kind of happening in the inner city or the urban schools. That's because they've already initiated very good security measures, single entrance, metal detectors, resource officers in the schools. And you usually find these kinds of incidents happening where people feel kind of relaxed. It was such a tragedy in Texas, and when you found more and more details about how someone left the door open, oh my goodness, you know, when I go to visit a school, either as a visitor or even occasionally I'll substitute teach, oh my goodness, you would think I was getting into Fort Knox because the area where, you know, where I serve, it is suburban, urban, slash urban. Administrators have to embark on strict training of the teaching staff and even the students. An environment is so necessary for the students to realize, you know what, students, if you hear something, say say something, if you know something, you're not being a snitch. You're not tattling. What you're doing is informing those who could help keep you safe and keep your friends safe and keep your teachers safe. So also with parents, letting the parents know that if they are in conversations with their children or their older students, you know, if they find out that something is a concern or something is amiss or if the student saw something on social media, please speak up. Inform those who can do something. Those kind of measures would be best. I would hate to see also money that's being, you know, poured into schools. Schools are getting more money than they have ever. I remember when I was in a school, if we had a budget of $10 million or something, some crazy numbers like some of these school districts are getting, oh my goodness, we wouldn't know what to do with it. And that's what's happening. So hopefully a lot of the money that's being poured into school districts are being used for some of those very same security measures that you find in many urban or inner city schools. Metal detectors, resource officers, security, cameras, and especially locked doors.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with child development author Dr. Vimal Green, and we're talking about, we started out talking a little bit, get a little background, talk with her about her book, and then talk about guns in schools or protecting schools. I know my next question is going to be somewhat crazy and something that an educator probably wouldn't want anything to do with, but is it time to arm our teachers, or is that the wrong approach?
Well, you know, Kevin, I think that if those teachers who are comfortable with carrying a concealed arm, if they have been trained, it's not that they they inherited a gun from their uncle and, you know, they've been keeping it in their closet and now they're going to bring it to school. No, if they have been trained, licensed, and have a cool head about them, well, you know what? It could be a deterrent. I would hate for it to get to the point, though, where teachers have to carry firearms. I think this whole movement that was coming through the schools a year or so ago about removing resource officers, I hope those people are now putting tape over their mouths and saying, we were wrong. We don't need to get rid of our resource officers. Right. Because they're keeping our schools safe. It was part of that whole defund the police, and it was filtering into the schools as defund the school resource officers. So hopefully, if we have resource officers who can handle the hallways, who are there, it's not just one officer in a school, you know, of 1,000 kids, hopefully it's more, and keeping their ears open, and, you know, the teachers won't have to resort to defending themselves and defending their students.
Well, it's interesting because that question is something I thought I would ask, because the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, it's been reported that he has not only called for teachers to be armed after tragic shooting, 18 students killed, one adult. But he's also calling for armed police at schools. I mean, is that what we want? We want the resource officer to not only be there to work with students, but also be their protector?
I think so. And I tell you why. For one thing, the school resource officers at the schools where I have been have been part of the school family. They haven't been, you know, just some nameless person standing in the middle of the hall with his arms crossed. No, they have become an integral part of the whole school community. You know, forming relationships with the kids, especially when those resource officers are male. You know, Lord knows we need more men in the schools. You know, we don't have that many men teachers, you know, compared to women teachers. But being able to have relationships with the kids and have a kind of camaraderie with the rest of the staff as well. So when a resource officer is brought in, and the kids see him or her, and they become familiar with them, and they become familiar with the school and on a protector role for the school, I think that's an excellent idea. I think it's an excellent idea. One thing I would really caution districts about is pulling policemen right off the street, right out the squad car, and putting them in schools, because it does take training. The kinds of decisions and actions that you would make if you were out on the street corner dealing with the drug dealer thug, you know, break into a store, is going to be different than you would with, say, a back-talking teenager in the hallway. And I think that's what happened in a couple of schools where I, you know, read about the school resource officer tackling the student, handcuffing the student, dragging the student. You know, they just have to be trained and realize that they have to treat some of these children with kid gloves.
See, one would think, though, we are so advanced. I mean, when it comes to technology, not only as a nation, but I think globally, you know, technology leaps and bounds, especially during the pandemic. I mean, we were able, you know, that we as a society were able to find a way to inoculate our population in a short amount of time and, you know, also use technology to at least still have school using platforms like Zoom and Teams. Could technology also play a bigger role in securing our schools?
Oh, yes. You know, there can be an extra, you know, eyes in the hallways. If there was some kind of way that the office would have a direct line instead of having to pick up the phone or the teacher in the classroom having to pick up the phone to call the office, and then the office has to then call 911. If there would be some direct line to law enforcement, you know, that could help. Again, like I said, the good old-fashioned security cameras, you know, the Ring doorbells, which are installed in a lot of schools in our area, you know, that kind of technology, very, very effective against keeping the traffic to a minimum and making sure that you're monitoring who is coming in and out of the school building.
Now, there continues to be calls for stricter gun laws, especially on the federal level. But could that, is that enough?
You know, I hate to wade into that whole debate. All I can say is this, that the Constitution of the United States guarantees in the Second Amendment the right to bear arms. And I would hate to see tragedies, although heartbreaking as they are, like this, to use to take away Americans' right to bear arms, because it's a slippery slope. It's a slippery slope, Kevin, that, okay, now we're going to take away these. Okay, now we're going to come back and take away these guns. Now we're going to come to, you know, and I don't want a disarmed America. I just don't. And people look at me, you know, as a black woman, they're saying, oh, you know, it's your people who are really, you know, suffering the violence and you know, that's happening in the cities. And that's true. But then again, the guns that protect my black people in the cities hopefully outnumber the guns that don't. And so there are a lot of times that those guns are helping people, be they the police or security or even private individuals defending their homes. And I would hate to see that tragedies like this are used against the Second Amendment.
Would it be better to say that the probably the more paramount problem is mental health, and that we haven't done enough when it comes to the area of mental health and identifying folks who need assistance? Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all, Kevin. I think you're spot on when you call to mental health, and also, you know, as a Christian, I have to say spiritual health as well.
Right.
When you have people who aren't, or especially young people, who aren't raised with a moral sense that would instill compassion and kind of protect them from this seemingly culture of death that's out there in our society, you know, that is really plaguing our young people. You know, they've already gone through the trauma of a pandemic, you know, with depression, you know, at all times high, self-harm, suicide rates, especially among our boys and young men. And, yes, that definitely has to be a part, the mental health, but also the spiritual health. I would love to see our faith leaders step up and become more involved and a more vocal proponent for helping our young people through all of this.
If you are just tuning in, we are privileged to be speaking with Dr. Vermel Green, who wrote the book, Please Teach Me Like I'm a Boy, 10 Steps to His Success in School and in Life. You know, you mentioned about the pandemic. Is it possible that our society has become angrier because of the pandemic and that we're going to see residuals like what happened in Uvalde, Texas, more?
I know our children are angry. People aren't as nice to each other as they used to be. I mean, I'm just thinking about road rage. We just got back from a trip out of state for the weekend. And, you know, just the way people drive and just the aggressiveness and, you know, threatening people that they don't know because why? I was just changing lanes. My goodness, I'm not trying to hurt you. Really, I'm not. And, it's just just an anger that's out there. And, of course, it filters into our children. And it's in the media, of course. You turn on I've gotten to the point now where I can't even watch the news because it's just, you know, hate and anger and killing and hate and anger and killing. And a steady diet of that is bound to get into your spirit and to your psyche until finally you're saying, oh, my goodness, you know, do I need to just check out early? And you wonder why people are depressed and suicidal after you suffer through all that. And our children are not immune. You know, they are not stupid. They can see the angst in the adults around them. You know, they're like little thermostats. You know, they can tell the temperature, you know, in the environment, be it at home or be it at school or be it out in the community. And so, yes, I think that the pandemic has done a number, but I'm an optimist in the fact that the great American spirit is not dead. I think that God has his hand on this country, and I really believe we're going to come back.
But interesting, talking as a Christian and as you look, I mean, some would say that, you know, the way things are digressing globally, that, you know, that we're heading towards the end times.
Hey, Maranatha, come Lord Jesus. But I part of me is saying, well, no, not part of me. I would say 99% of me is saying, yes, Jesus, come on. Yep. But then another part of me is like, Lord, I would love to see you turn things around and see a revival to sweep. You know, I'm old enough to remember the Jesus movement of the early 1970s. Oh, my word, that was an exciting time in this country. And I would love to see something that would even surpass that to sweep across this nation and sweep around the world so that people are saying, wow, look where we were and look at where we are now.
But I'm going to ask you this, and that is you look at religion, you look at what we've seen with different religions, you know, whether it's the Catholic religion and the scandals we've seen in regards to priests and, you know, sex scandals. Is it hard for folks to believe a religion when those who are providing the word are up to other things?
You know what? First of all, I don't follow religion. I don't consider myself religious. I consider myself a Christian.
Yep.
And I think that those people who really have a relationship with the Lord, where it's part of their being and it's part of their thinking and their doing and their heart, I don't believe they are the ones that are involved in this. When religion gets into it, you know, anything can happen because, you know, man has a propensity to sin, to do wrong. And whether he wears a collar or a frock or if he has a R-E-V in front of his name, you know, So these kinds of things happen. So people need to get their eyes off of man, because man will fail you.
Yes.
And get your eyes on the Lord.
Well said. As we are coming to the close, we just got a couple of minutes left here. Anything in closing in regards to our topic, in regards to the sad happenings down in Uvalde, Texas, and thoughts on any possible future shootings that we see like this?
Well, the main things that parents can do, because it may happen again, I pray that it doesn't. I pray that schools are putting very simple measures into place. At the same time, I want to tell parents, please hold on to your children, love your children, make sure that they are feeling safe, make sure that they know that they can talk to you, because our kids for the past 2 years have gone through such trauma, and it will be interesting to see how they're doing in another 30 years from now. But in the meantime, parents, step up. Support your schools, support your children, support your teachers. Hold those teachers accountable, though. Don't let them off the hook when it comes to teaching those values that you hold dear. But definitely hold your children, talk to your children, be there for your children. They are the most important resource that you have. Your children are a message that you send into a time that you will never see. So, parents, make sure that message that you send is a good one.
And let's have folks, if folks want to grab your book, is it easy to attain? Is it Amazon? Is there a website they can go to? Is it Barnes & Noble?
It is on Amazon, Amazon.com. Please teach me like I'm a boy. It gives a book, a list of strategies to teach your sons. It'll be for parents, for teachers, for educators, knowing how to teach boys in a way that they learn best. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and also Apple iBooks.
Now, before I let you go any further, one piece of business we haven't touched upon, and that is the Boys Initiative. Could you give us some details on that in case there are folks who are interested?
Absolutely. The BoysInitiative.org. We are an advocacy group raising awareness on the issues affecting our boys. We have a weekly newsletter filled with tips on parenting boys, teaching boys. We also have news articles regarding boys' issues. Many of them are not reported in mainstream media. We also have training opportunities. In fact, I'm doing a webinar tomorrow on how to teach boys and how boys learn best. We have an upcoming seminar in October. So all you have to do is go onto our website, theboysinitiative.org, and sign up. Thank you, Kevin, for allowing me and reminding me to mention the Boys Initiative. We appreciate that.
Yeah, it's you know, I was looking at the website, and I was finding it fascinating that there is somewhere to go to, you know, help boys and understand that there's a difference between boys and girls. And, you know, if you have, you know, three sons, that, you know, that maybe this is something that, you know, if it's going to be of value to get involved with.
I hope so. In fact, we've got four networks for teachers, moms, dads, and also the faith community. Those networks are designed to give you information to equip you to advocate for your son, because our boys need someone speaking up for them, to school boards, to legislators, to policymakers, saying we must do more to help our boys, because if our boys are in trouble, so are we all.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us and talking about so many different topics all in one phone call.
Oh, wow. It has been a lot, hasn't it? Kevin, thank you again for this opportunity to speak to you and to your listeners.
You have yourself a great evening, and hopefully we can talk again somewhere down the road.
All right. Just give me a call. I'll be there.
You got it. It's Dr. Vimel Green, who has been our guest here on 95.9 WATD. What a fantastic show. I want to definitely take a moment to thank all of our guests. We remind you that we are a couple of episodes behind on the podcast, and we will do our best to get those up as soon as possible. Hopefully by the end of the week we'll be up to date. So keep that in mind. Hey, listen, till next week at 6:15 p.m., you have yourself a great evening.